is always gonna be here anyway.
Thinking of you's working up my appetite. Looking forward to a little afternoon delight. Rubbing sticks and stones together make the sparks ignite. And the thought of rubbing you is getting so excited.
Skyrockets in flight.
I think it makes good sense. I think that song sounds even more pervy that way. Starland Vocal Band, Afternoon Delight. But I kind of feel a little sick. That was the Starland Vocal Band, Afternoon Delight, 45. Tusanuskat before that. Collaboration of members of Kemiela Sedistavat and others. Don't think there are song titles. Nope. Untitled track number 4. A CD entitled Naksa Na Munkinilit. Terrors. Before that, great new CD. It's called Lagan Chord. Compiling cassette recordings over the past several years. The track we heard called Soft Proliferating Light, which I misspelled on the playlist page. They're fixed. Don't know how you pronounce the band before that. It's like celery without the final Y, so we'll call them Cellar. A beautiful record called Vestiges of an Inherent Melancholy, and we heard excerpts of side 2. Before that, DDAA, Déficit des Années Antérieures, from the La Famille des Saltimbanques cassette, Ne Plus Rien Voir, / Le Cargo du Soir. Before that, music from Sophie Cooper and Ben Nash. CD is called Alchemy. We heard excerpts from track one called Natural Liberation. New music before that from Kindest Lines, a song called Prom Song, closing out their Covered in Dust LP. Before that, DJ Alf of the Hip Hop Slam. Great new CD of his, it's called Vintage. We heard Vintro. Esplendor Geometrico from the Minimal Wave Tapes Volume 1 compilation, the track Moscú Está Helado. Atoll before that, the track was called Jose, 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 came from the new volume of Yeti Magazine CD compilation, always enclosed with that great magazine. Blue Sausage Infant, our pal, opened that set from his new record called Negative Space, and a track entitled Negative Space. And that's everything we heard. My name is Scott. Thank you so much for listening today. Do want to remind those of you in Fairfield County, Connecticut, Putnam County, New York, and Westchester County, New York, that you have still got a severe thunderstorm warning effective till like 6:38 p.m. And if you're in Westchester County, you've also got yourself a flash flood warning. That's effective till 7:54. My name is Scott. See you next week. Thanks for listening. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide on the internet, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is coming right up.
Monday, 12 a.m.
Steve, how you doing? This is a good buddy from high school.
Who?
Well, I'm not really your good buddy. I'm actually the guy you held my head down in the toilet and flushed it, and it's kind of scarred me for years. And I went through this firewalking seminar, and they said we had to get in touch with our childhood and people that abused us. I just want to say what you did was wrong, and I want to challenge you to a fist fight on some coals, hot coals, nude fist fight out in the woods. I've got to recover my masculinity, and you've taken it away from me, buddy. People laughed at me for 20 years about that toilet thing. Toilet head, they call me. They still do, where I work. I work at McDonald's in Burlingame. That's how I found you. You came in to get some burger or something and paid with a check. Got your name from that, and I'm pissed as hell, buddy. We got a score to settle. Let's settle right now. You know Chuck Woolery from Love Connection?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's a friend of mine. Anyway, where do you want to settle this?
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
You don't remember me from...
I have no doubt that there are a lot of people in this country who are reacting to having a black president and reacting by organizing. But the Tea Party itself, the sort of seeds of it, come from economics, not from race. I think no recession, no Tea Party.
Zephyr Teachout is one of the internet's original organizers. In 2003, she ran Howard Dean's insurgent online campaign. And for years, she's worked on projects that marry activism and the internet. But in the fall of 2008, when the financial crisis struck, she says she found a new focus.
I go away for a weekend, and Lehman Brothers collapses. And ever since then, I have a hard time thinking about anything but banking and political power. And I'm not alone. There was a huge national reaction to the bank collapse. The majority of Americans did not want $700 billion bailout. And everywhere you go, you talk to people who talk not just about how they were angry about the bailouts, but about how this is a time we got to start from scratch. Left, right, center, apathetic, said, something's weird with the economy. We have to start from scratch.
At first, Zephyr Teachout is hopeful. She thinks that Obama might seize the opportunity to remake the economy. But instead, his economic team of Summers and Geithner doubled down on the Bush policies.
The policy is that this is a confidence game. And they talk about it as a confidence game. As long as people have confidence in the economy, everything's going to be okay. So there's a word for a confidence game. It's called a con game. And it's a very dangerous way to run an economy. It's a Ponzi scheme economy. So I've been following this. I've been starting to think about antitrust law. What are ways that we can get engaged to, you know, break up these incredibly politically powerful financial institutions?
And then in 2009, before there really even is a Tea Party, a friend emails Zephyr a link.
I click on the link. It's called A New Way Forward. It says we should do three things: nationalize the banks, reorganize the banks, and decentralize the banks. So nationalize them, then reorganize, which is get rid of the bad leadership, and then break them up, and send them back to a much more dispersed banking around the country. The woman who wrote me said that she wanted to talk to me about translating the online organizing into offline organizing. So we had several long phone conversations and decided to hold events on April 11th, 2009. There were about 90 events scheduled for around the country. The event I went to had about 120 people in North Carolina. There was a pretty big event in San Diego, a great event in San Francisco, and then a few events that had ended up with one or four people. So the hope is we would have chapters in every state. We would be breathing down the necks of Congress members who hadn't thought about economic policy before, but would suddenly have to adopt a break up the banks policy. We would be making somebody like Tim Geithner toxic to the administration. That there was this real sense that the old institutions, all these institutions are changing. War is changing. War isn't war anymore. Banks aren't banks anymore. Schools aren't schools anymore. Newspapers aren't newspapers anymore. And in this incredible interregnum, there's a possibility of people, taking some real power. Now, I can't say I thought it was for sure going to happen, but it just seemed like there was a chance. Now, the Tea Party had already started. There had been a few articles about it. But at least initially, at least some of the people who came out to early Tea Party events were reacting against, bank oligarchy and feeling like they're working hard and the banks are getting bailed out. The initial groundswell of response seems to actually be about real anger about TARP, about the bailouts, about banking power. That is a left and right anger. This is not, it is highly political. I don't want to be all cute and nonpartisan, but it's highly political, but it is not just left or just right. So I see the Tea Party as evidence of one of the things that I've been hoping for a long time, which is real massive political structural change. We never made our way into the news ecology. Now, some of that's our fault. We weren't as good with the media. But some of that is that the Tea Party had sponsors in the media. We got covered initially by Bill Moyers in a two-minute segment. So that's nice. But getting covered by Bill Moyers in a two-minute segment is very different than being on television, MSNBC and Fox, CNN, and in not just New York Times, Washington Post, but hyper-local papers. So you cannot underestimate the power of the media in creating the possibility for organizing. If you've never heard of A New Way Forward, how would you ever join it? And then we don't have any money, which makes a big difference. I was a law professor. Tiffany does web consulting. Donnie works for another nonprofit. There are about 30 different people who became very active nationally. Every single one of them has a day job. So it's a very different thing to then say, okay, let's organize a second round of events. We organized a second round of events. We had 35 instead of 90. You can actually see how money does make a difference. Not maybe millions, although millions would have made a big difference. But here's the counterfactual. The question is, what if we'd had the kind of money that the Koch brothers are investing in Americans for Prosperity in the Tea Party? What if MSNBC talked about us an hour a day? And when I say us, I would mean like the Tea Party, A New Way Forward, Progressive Change Caucus Commission, the Coffee Party, all these various groups that were bubbling up during the same time. What if we collectively had millions of dollars in backing and daily popular television coverage? We would be more powerful than the Tea Party right now. People would be scared of us. I've been to a handful of Tea Party events, and they're fascinating. And I can see the money. I can see what it costs to put together an event at a baseball stadium. I'm so envious. What if we had money for a baseball stadium and to reach every reporter in the country on a dime's notice? It's frustrating the way that pundits talk about it as if it exists in this really concrete form, as if everybody's meeting every night. And, you know, I'm an organizer, and so I check in on things like, how many events are they actually having? How many local groups are there really? I went to an event in Arizona that was advertised every night for 3 weeks. There were about 400 people at that event. If I had that kind of advertising power, we'd have a lot more than 400 people. So it's frustrating that the press has sort of accepted the Tea Party and is going to talk about the Tea Party as this thing when it's a press-created thing. Everything about the Tea Party is frustrating. Because the economy falls apart and the biggest grassroots movement is one that has nothing to do with the people who broke the economy. That's crazy. It was possible in 2009, 2010 to break up the banks so all of them were less than $50 billion. It was possible to put on usury laws so they couldn't loan at these incredibly high rates that are killing people in this country. We could have stopped these crazy foreclosures. I mean, all of those were politically possible things. But the moment for a real economic populist, progressive, but really populist uprising might have passed.
This interview with Sefer Teachout is from the three-part series I produced on the Tea Party in America back in October of 2010. I called the series Beyond the Fruited Plain, and you can listen to all three episodes on the TMI archive page. Sadly, those who thought that they'd just be a fringe minority have been proved wrong. The debt ceiling debate shows us that this minority fringe group is more than willing to hold American democracy hostage. They said they'd change the way business was done in Washington, and they did. It turns out extortion works better than compromise. So in honor of this new real politic, I pulled together a few of the more pertinent segments from Beyond the Fruited Plain for you. It's a Tea Party remix.
Morning, I was driving to my first day at my brand new job, and I turned on the radio, and there was Nita Thunberg with this unbelievable story. I hadn't heard of this yet, but Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder is his name. He was a gay soldier killed in Iraq, and there were these extreme protesters protesting his funeral while his parents mourned just because he's gay. And they're not just like protesting his funeral, but got holding signs that say God hates fags and implying that he should have died and that he was killed and all of our soldiers are being killed because of homosexuals in America.
Andrea, these guys are everywhere. They're old news. They're the God hates fags people.
Yeah, they're the God hates fags people. But get this, and this is, I'm like sitting there crying over the story and I had no idea the whole time. The God hates fags people, they're from Missouri. I live now in a state that breathes those terrifying extremists that are making me cry while I listen to public radio.
Like, hold on a second. I thought you moved to Kansas.
Kansas City is in Kansas, and Kansas City is also in Missouri.
There's two?
Yes.
I've gone through my whole life not knowing that there are two Kansas cities. I guess it's one of those things you don't really have to know about. Like TV.
Okay. I grew up in Midwestern suburbs, like same cookie cutter town with big box stores and big suburban neighborhoods. And they were all like nice Midwestern cities with excellent schools. And as I was growing up in these communities, then I like swore I would never move back. Like, it was my biggest goal in the world to move out east, go to college, live in New York City. And I did all of that. Like, I got to meet Moby then.
You cannot tell me that it is okay to move to Kansas City now because you met Moby. That is not the highlight of your New York City life.
Moby kissed my cheek then. He gave me his personal card.
Oh my God.
We had a connection.
Oh.
I'm just saying. So, but like, I was like living the life, but I realized as I left to start this new job, I had to drive through one of the towns where I used to live, West Des Moines, Iowa. And I had a beer with a friend from that town, and I drove past my old house, and I just realized, like, why did I run away from these places, these suburban suburbs? Like, in these places, I can be a big shot. And in New York City, I was always just working to be a big shot. But I'm a big shot in Kansas City already. I feel like a genius here. I wasn't even thinking of this while I was doing all that crying in the car, but I actually wear makeup now. Before my job interview for this position, I did a how to wear makeup class at Aveda. And I now wear like mascara and eyeliner and eyeshadow because I have this idea that you gotta need to look professional to be taken seriously in my new job. I know how to put it on now. I just wasn't really thinking about how it seems to come off. So I'm sitting there in the parking lot outside of the human resources office, like cleaning up my eye makeup and making sure I look perfect for my big training day at human resources. It was my first experience with any kind of interaction with the human resources department because at my last job, I was a contract freelancer and I never actually got to interact with HR until I was fired. Like, I never got to read the, like, manual. I never got to learn about how benefits work, what a flex spending account is. And there I was in this HR meeting and it was like, yes, I am here. I've arrived in my adult life. And everyone else in the HR meeting were actually recently hired janitors. So we went around in a circle and we all said what we were there for, what our new jobs are going to be. And when it got to me and I got to say that I was starting a job at the radio station, I just felt like the coolest person in the world. I just felt like a big shot because they're all like, when's your radio show? What's the call numbers? You know, like, can we listen? Oh, wow, I love the radio. I listen when I clean classrooms. Like, it was really like my first moment announcing myself to Kansas City.
You're saying you feel like a big shot because you're better than the janitors.
Well, I mean, I was happy. We were all getting salaries and life insurance and you know, like, they're getting this great job too. Like, we're all signed up for a lot of security. I was really happy to get to say what I was here to do, and a lot of the janitors said that they were going to listen to the show. This is your worst nightmare.
It is. It is. It totally is.
No, there's nothing wrong with Kansas City. It's really nice here, Ben. If anyone who's ever lived here really loves it. Kansas City, something I heard about Kansas City before I even moved here, before I even considered a job here, was that they had this blossoming arts and culture scene. But when you say that to people here, they get kind of offended because they feel like it's already really arrived.
I hear this all the time, actually. New York, L.A., Kansas City. I mean, that's what you read in all the art magazines.
Wait, are you joking or are you serious?
Andrea.
Because I think...
Of course I'm joking.
Because I've heard from people that the Kansas City art scene is really phenomenal. Artists are choosing to live here. They're not living here because this is where they grew up and they hope to make it to New York someday. Like, artists are choosing to live here. Artists who are represented by national galleries are all choosing to live here. And there's a lot of artistic collaboration that's happening across the city.
Where? Where'd you hear that?
I heard it on the radio station.
Well, then I guess we can look forward to a pretty awesome collaborative art project. You, the janitors, and the God Hates Fags people.
Okay.
On November 14, 1775, the Revolutionary forces were dealt a most cruel of blows. John Murray, the 4th Earl of Dunmore and the Royal Governor of the Colony of Virginia, issued a proclamation. Now, even though Lord Dunmore had been forced to abandon his estate at Williamsburg, he was still directing operations against the Patriots from his ship off the coast of Yorktown, and this proclamation was perhaps his greatest offensive move. Dunmore's proclamation offered freedom to all slaves belonging to rebels able to bear arms for the crown. It is the first large-scale emancipation of slave labor in American history. Within a month, several hundred slaves risked their lives in escape and joined him. It is a dark, dark moment for our freedom-loving ancestors, because this put them in an impossible situation, in the middle, fighting both their British overlords and their rebelling slaves. The Virginia Convention quickly drafted a counter-proclamation, which reminded the slaves that the punishment for escape would be death, a horrible death without benefit of clergy or mercy. But still, freedom beckoned. It is estimated that up to 100,000 attempted escape. The men who did manage to reach Dunmore joined his Ethiopian regiment, and by December 1775, this regiment had nearly 300 blacks, including its most famous member, the escaped slave named Titus. Titus and his comrades wore regimental uniforms inscribed with the words, "Liberty to Slaves." They believed they were not just fighting for their own individual freedom, but for freedom and liberty itself. During the winter of 1776, nearly half of Dunmore's forces were black, and when they fought against the North Carolina troops at the Battle of the Great Bridge, they captured two colonels. One was even taken by his former slave. News of this event spread like wildfire and only fueled Lord Dunmore's undoing, for he vastly misjudged how those not caught up in the loyalist or rebel cause, the Great Middle, would take his proclamation. The moderates exclaimed that Lord Dunmore's proclamation was blasphemy, a direct offense of their rights and dignities. But I think it was really the idea of being molested by one's property that kept them up at night. But regardless, they began to accept what the radicals had been saying for some time, that the protection of their freedoms and rights was worth fighting for. Unfortunately, the Ethiopian regiment did not get to see much battle. They were decimated by a smallpox outbreak in less than a year. And Titus died from a gangrene infection from a musket wound. When the war ended, the British, determined to make good on their promise of freedom, evacuated almost 300 former slaves to Nova Scotia. But the victorious Americans were just as determined to make an example of the slaves who had dared to interfere in their glorious fight for freedom. Some plantation owners even journeyed to the north, seizing blacks off the streets of New York and Boston. But they were the lucky ones. There are many accounts of former slaves who were executed in the most barbaric and horrific fashion. Decapitations, flayings, burnings. On one occasion, a 15-year-old girl is thrashed to death by her former master, and before she dies, he places hot embers in her wounds. I realize, of course, it's bad form to bring stuff up like this. Race and slavery do have a way of mucking up America's glorious historical narrative. But I must confess that all the outrage and all the shouting of late has set my overactive imagination spinning. And I just can't get this scene out of my head. I'm in a jail cell with a bunch of intellectuals and bohemians. And just beyond the bars, our jailers, who are decked out in these red, white, and blue overalls, are arguing about our fate.
one keeps shouting with determination. Well, what would the founding fathers do? But, well, to better understand the Tea Party's actual relationship with American history, let's turn to Jill Lepore, who's a professor of American history at Harvard, a writer at The New Yorker, and the author of the new book, The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History.
Here at Harvard, I teach an undergraduate research course on the American Revolution, and I started for the first time in the spring of 2009, that semester. So right after the inauguration of Barack Obama, our semester began, and I and my students started undertaking our investigation into the revolution. And that February, just a few weeks after the inauguration, the Tea Party movement began when CNBC commentator Rick Santelli delivered what came to be called the rant around the world. And he called for a new Tea Party to reject the Obama administration's bailout package and all of its economic policies. And so I had this sort of surreal experience of, you know, having breakfast, reading the newspaper, seeing people dressed up in 18th century costumes, saying the time for revolution has come again. We are enduring taxation without representation. We're calling ourselves the Tea Party. And then I'd go teach my students where we'd discuss, you know, the historiography and scholarly debates about the revolution and its origins. And then we'd traipse around Boston because the course has a big field trip component. And after some while, we began kind of bumping into people who were interested in the Tea Party for very different reasons than we were interested in it as students and as teachers. It turns out that the Boston chapter of the Tea Party was meeting at a place called the Green Dragon Tavern. That is actually a site on the Freedom Trail. It's this kind of sort of pseudo 18th century tavern, and it's where the Sons of Liberty met in the 1760s and, you know, plotted their resistance to British authority, to parliamentary authority. So that too was fascinating, just that the people in the Tea Party here took so seriously their connection to the Sons of Liberty and to the struggles of the 18th century that they wanted to kind of meet in those same places. And it's a sort of a version of wearing the tri-cornered hat and the knee breeches and waving the Constitution around. So I decided I really ought to go try to find out more about them. It's not that often as a scholar of the 18th century anyone is especially interested in what you study. But for these people, there seemed to be a kind of easy collapsing of the distance in time between the 1770s and the present, that somehow our struggle is like theirs. This is just like in 1773. We are just like the Sons of Liberty. I found this shocking, frankly.
Shocking like these people are stupid, or shocking like this does not bode well for the future of the country?
There are two chief misinterpretations of the 18th century, I would say, that have important consequences. One is the idea that the 18th century was a simpler, quieter time marked by unity and less divisiveness. When in fact, and especially, I think for a lot of these people, the 18th century is a kind of time before race. And so they've got these white founders and their white wigs. And this is not to say that the movement is racist at all, but to say that the fantasy, in fact, the longing for a time of unity, it finds a home, an easy purchase in this fable of the 18th century. When in fact, the 18th century was not an easy and less troubled time. And certainly the story of slavery is integrally tied into the story of liberty, as, you know, all scholars who study this period will tell you, and as if you examine writings of 18th century writers will be abundantly obvious. So I think to take the story of slavery out of American history is a very dangerous thing.
You say this isn't racist, but why would anyone other than a racist want to take race out of history?
Yeah, no, I think they are linked. There was an interesting poll done, I think USA Today did it in the spring, asking people who identified themselves as sympathetic to the Tea Party whether they thought everyone in the United States had an equal chance at an education or an equal chance at employment and an equal chance at economic success. And I talked to the reporter who was writing a story about that poll, and she said, you know, you can't actually ask people, you know, are you racist? Like, it's not a thing you can measure in that way as a pollster. But you can measure whether people think that we all start out with an equal chance in life and that there is no such thing as discrimination anymore. And people in the Tea Party represent that view, hold that view disproportionately to people in the general population. And I don't think, I mean, I think there's a generous reading of that would be to say that these are people who are exhausted by racial struggle and want to imagine that we live in a post-racial age. I talked to a lot of people in the Tea Party who felt very strongly about this, you know, that racism was a thing of the past, that racial inequality was a thing of the past, and to harp on it was, and to structure government programs around the premise that it exists, was an act of injustice to them. And this is something that a lot of people said and believed. And I do think that having a version of American history, a version of the American Revolution that does not involve paying attention to the agonizing struggle over slavery during that period makes holding those views more possible. And so therefore, I think worrying.
Now, you said there were two things that worried you as a historian. What's the second thing?
The second thing is, this is perhaps more widespread. There's within and around this movement, and certainly in the far right, is an often stated belief that the founding fathers were prophets, that the Constitution was divinely inspired and is holy writ, and speaks to us across the ages in a timeless and ageless way. It comes alive to us the way the gospel, what Jesus is witnessing in the gospel, comes alive to us today. People will say that very explicitly. And that amounts to what I call historical fundamentalism. It is to take a religious view, a very certain and particular kind of religious view, religious fundamentalism, and apply it to the study of the past. And it's antithetical, of course, to the ideas of the Enlightenment, which were themselves based on skepticism, and which is where the historical profession today gets its premise of investigative inquiry and empirical research. So, I have spoken to people in the movement who would say, you know, we would never have the audacity to question the words of great men. Well, that is actually what the study of history is. It is actually interrogating documents and thinking about things. But nothing could be further from the truth than that the founding fathers were themselves eager to have their words taken in this reverential way. I mean, you know, Jefferson is perhaps the person who said it best when he said, you know, some men will look upon constitutions with sanctimonious reverence and deem them, like the Ark of the Covenant, too sacred to be touched. They will grant to the people of a previous age a wisdom greater than human, and that we cannot abide that, because laws must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. That was the sensibility of the political philosophers of the 18th century, not one of abject reverence of documents. I mean, Madison also said that the glory of America was that we do not blindly venerate the past. So that misconception is, I think, quite important, because if you bring in that element of fundamentalism to how we think about the founding documents, we no longer have a pluralist political culture where we can debate how to proceed as a polity. We have one group of people saying that they know what God revealed to the founding fathers in this document, who can tell everybody else that they're blasphemers for questioning it. You know, it's religious fundamentalism. It is turning the Constitution into a religion.
And so, to prepare, my dear listener, I've gathered together a group of experts, journalists, academics, historians, artists, conspiracy theorists, and friends, to help us take stock of the situation and plan accordingly. So, let's get to it. We'll start with the journalist Will Bunch, author of the book Backlash: Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama.
You know, I traveled across country from Arizona to Massachusetts, talking to people involved in the movement. And when I asked them how they got involved in Tea Party type activities, the answers I got were often the same, that they were just not comfortable with Barack Obama. You know, they would say, I saw Barack Obama on TV and he was talking about change, or he was talking about transformation, and it made me very uncomfortable, or I felt uneasy with Obama. But what happened, and this is something that you can see happening in the internet age, in particular, aided by the right wing media structure of Fox News and talk radio, is I think people started looking for what they considered facts, what you or I might consider to be conspiracy theories for the most part, that backed up their negative reaction to Obama.
But when we talk about the Tea Party movement and facts, though, it seems that there are two distinct things going on. For example, those who believe Obama was not born in Hawaii, this is just a denial of facts. I mean, on top of the actual birth certificate, there are birth announcements in two Hawaii newspapers. But when you look at something like the Oath Keepers and their relationship with facts, it seems that we're talking about something different, worse, a whole denial of factual reality.
Yeah, the core idea of the Oath Keepers is that the oath that you take is to the Constitution. So you're giving yourself kind of the power to decide in the field whether you're getting an order that's violating the Constitution. Well, that's not the oath they take. The oath they take requires them to follow orders from the commander-in-chief. So kind of the core notion of what they're all about isn't even true.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's a denial of reality. And so I just want to ask right off the bat, does this whole thing just boil down to racism?
Whether you want to call it racist or rooted in race, there's an interesting term that's come into use in the last couple of years, kind of para-racial, which are, I think, are issues that you can say aren't couched in overtly racial terms, but at the same time have something to, basically get back to people's anxieties about race or ethnicity. And I certainly found a lot of that. But, I think the broader fear is the erosion of what you might call white culture in this country. They feel that their culture, which is predominantly white and predominantly Christian, and is kind of rooted in parts of America that are outside of the cities generally, whether it's suburbs or more rural areas. And they feel their culture is threatened by a number of things. They feel it's threatened by immigration, even if they live in areas where there are not a lot of immigrants, but they feel that immigration is a threat. They've been led to believe kind of ridiculously that there's a threat from, Muslim people settling in this country. And I think they also see lifestyle change. They see kind of increasing acceptance of gay rights, perhaps increasing acceptance of, say, atheism or whatever. There's a lot of changes, cultural changes in this country that these people, I think, see as threats. And I think the arrival of Obama as president very suddenly to these people in 2008 was kind of a jolt that made them feel like America was changing too much too soon, and Obama was the symbol of that. And I think that's important to these people, that they show that they're here, that they're not going away, that they're not fading into irrelevance. I'm always struck by the famous line that Sarah Palin uttered during the 2008 campaign, where she was in a small town and she said, "It's good to be campaigning again in the pro-America parts of America." And that was no gaffe. I mean, that was kind of a core belief that when you talk to people, and again, I interviewed dozens of Tea Party supporters in the course of doing this book, and these are the kind of beliefs that small town America is the pro-America part of America, and that when you get to like an urban area, it's not that it's not America. I mean, perhaps the most critical scene in the whole book is when I was talking to the leaders of the Delaware 912 Patriots, who've been getting a lot of attention because of their support of successfully of Christine O'Donnell in the Senate race recently. I had a long scene in the diner with them where they were basically trying to explain to me that Obama wasn't really the legitimate winner of the 2008 election, and he wasn't really the legitimate winner of the state of Delaware, even though their state, even though he carried Delaware by 100,000 votes, which in a small state like Delaware is a landslide basically. And I was trying to I don't get it. What are you trying to say? And basically, what they really were saying was that votes from the city of Wilmington, which is predominantly or 50% perhaps Black and Latino, didn't count as much as like their votes from the rural parts of Delaware. And it's like, why? And it's like, well, those are the handout people, that they see these people who are predominantly minorities as being on the government dole or whatever. And that their votes like don't count as much. I mean, it's really a stunning idea when you think about it.
Actually, it doesn't seem stunning. These people are simply racist morons. It's just that simple.
I think human nature is to look for simpler answers to the complex problems, and the problems that America is facing right now are complex. I mean, I don't think there's any bigger problem that we have right now than the destruction of the middle class. This is something that's been going on in this country for 40 or 50 years, and It's complicated. It has to do with globalization. It has to do with automation, for example. I mean, if you're somebody who is from Wisconsin and you've been in manufacturing and all of a sudden you're 48 years old and your job has been outsourced to China and it's not coming back and you've got to figure out what you're going to do for the next 20, 25, 30 years of your life, that's pretty scary, you know? And this is the cauldron of, you know, anxiety and terror, if you will, that's out there. I think these pseudo facts are part of their defense of their culture. And there's some people who are very good at cynically manipulating these fears and transferring them to Obama.
I was really struck when I was spending time with people in the Tea Party in Boston, people I liked a lot and was really interested in hearing what they thought about American politics and about American history, by how much the activism reminded me of some of the protests of the bicentennial. So if you think about the 200th anniversary of the American Revolution, what a big deal that was. It was a really big deal here in Massachusetts where I grew up. And every time I'd see these people with their tri-cornered hats and invoking the memory of the revolution, I was sort of swamped with memories of the bicentennial, my own kind of childhood experience of going to the March the Freedom Trail. And I remembered going to the Boston Tea Party ship and dumping the tea into the harbor, this kind of replica ship. I had a really strong memory of that. I was like, well, whatever happened to that ship? Because I remembered bringing my kids to it years ago. And I went down to, you know, where it used to be docked in Boston Harbor. It's not there anymore. It turns out it was set on fire and is now up in Gloucester for repairs. And so I went up to see it in Gloucester and climbed on board, and I just was really flooded with memories of the bicentennial. And then I went into the archives and investigated that. And if you think about those years from sort of 1965 to 1976 were the years of the bicentennial celebration, when the federal government was attempting to organize a national celebration of the American Revolution, kind of beginning with the 200th anniversary of the Stamp Act and ending with the 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Those were very unhappy years in the United States. We're looking at the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Malcolm X on the heels of the assassination of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. We're looking at Vietnam. We're looking at very difficult years in the civil rights movement, the shootings at Kent State in 1970, which happened just 2 months after the anniversary of the Boston Massacre. And by 1973, when a bunch of guys in Boston have brought over this replica 18th century ship for the 200th anniversary of the dumping of the tea, Nixon is being impeached for the Watergate scandal. So no one knows how to celebrate the founding of the United States. There's just this kind of political free-for-all where, especially on the left, but also on the right, everyone wants to make the argument, oh, it is just like it was 200 years ago. So during the Boston Massacre reenactments in 1970, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War want to say, oh, yeah, the Kent State shooting's just like this. And in the 18th century, they were so opposed to a standing army, and that's why we shouldn't be in Vietnam. Or, you know, during the dumping of the tea, people got on board, the protesters got on board the ship and disrupted the reenactment, calling for Nixon's impeachment. People in 1974 in Boston argued that they were acting in the tradition of the Sons of Liberty by opposing busing, the integration of Boston's public schools. I mean, there was this kind of political free-for-all with, like, rampant analogies to the American Revolution. And historians at just kind of that, academic historians at just that moment had really kind of backed out of public conversation about history, partly, I think, quite appalled by this hucksterish and sort of shameless use of the story of the nation's founding by political activists of all stripes. But again, I think maybe more especially from the left. And so the kind of story of the nation's founding as any kind of unifying story completely unraveled. And so when I would see people here in Boston, or, you know, just looking at rallies across the country and studying the rhetoric of people who were, you know, purportedly leaders of the Tea Party movement, what these people seemed to want, I think, so desperately was a story about who we are as a people that made sense to them and that wasn't so disaggregated and wasn't so ridden with conflict as what emerged from that bicentennial moment.
So today, then, as we battle over history again, do you see a path that we can take as a country, a way out or way forward?
Well, you know, I think that there exists, and academic historians have been writing a pluralist and thoughtful history of the United States, and it exists in the best textbooks, and it exists in the best classrooms. I think it exists in the best elementary schools. I think it is actually out there. It's now that it's just being so defied by people who want to insist on this interpretation as being a left-wing conspiracy. You know, because the story of the United States is a story of conflict and a story of struggle and a story of many different kinds of people struggling with one another to seek what is the best promise and meaning of the ideals of the founding. I was really moved when I was working on this book by reading a speech that Thurgood Marshall gave in 1987 at the 200th anniversary of the drafting of the Constitution. This was the year that Robert Bork was nominated for the Supreme Court, and there was much debate about originalism, and there was much hoopla about the Constitution. And from the far right, there was much of this kind of, oh, it was divinely inspired, and it's incontrovertible. And Marshall said, you know, he was the first African-American on the Supreme Court. He had argued in Brown v. the Board of Education in 1954. He had a lot to say about the history of racial inequality in the United States. He had a lot of experience with it. And he said, you know, asked to give a speech on the occasion of the bicentennial of the Constitution, I will not celebrate the Constitution with blind veneration. I will not make a blind pilgrimage to the National Archives and worship a document that was flawed at the start. I will celebrate quietly and not by flag waving. I will celebrate quietly this Constitution as a living document, and I will especially celebrate the 200 years of struggle by Americans who have sought to realize and to bring into the world the rights that it guaranteed.
The other night, I am in my car on the way home from grocery shopping, and I get this text. Actually, it's a sext from this Republican chick that I hook up with sometimes.
You hook up with Republicans?
Yeah. If you work on the Hill long enough, it's going to happen. And I'm sure it's just as weird for them as it is for me. So this chick, we'll just call her Kathy. She sexts me, and she's at an event at a TGI Fridays, and she wants me to come pick her up
for sex.
Yeah.
So you have like an enemies with benefits relationship, basically.
Exactly. So I get to this TGI Fridays, and it's like packed. And I'm kind of, you know, looking around, and it's a little bit dark and it's kind of loud, and I'm maneuvering through the crowd, like trying to find this chick. And, you know, I pass some guy, and he's got like the t-shirt with the fake Obama birth certificate from Kenya. And I'm looking around, I'm kind of taking this in, and it dawns on me, like, everybody here is like white and old and kind of angry. And I realized, like, holy crap, this is a Tea Party rally. So I'm pushing my way through the crowd, and finally I see Kathy. She's sitting at the bar, and I walk over to her, and I'm like, what are you doing here? Isn't this a Tea Party rally? And she says, yes, it is a Tea Party rally. And she hoists this huge margarita with like an American flag in it. And she says, and I am the Republican hall monitor. And I'm just like, what? Well, wait a minute. The Tea Party, I mean, they don't like the Republicans any more than I do. And she looks at me with like this little frowny face and says, oh, Chris, don't be so sad. They just like us better. And then she leans out and yells at this guy walking by, like, hey, Tommy, come here for a second. And it's the first dude I saw, the guy with the birth certificate t-shirt. It says, this is my friend Chris, and he is a Democrat. And the guy's like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, hey, how you doing? And she says, Tommy, what is your most important issue for the election? And he says, well, I just think, you know, we got a president that isn't even a U.S. citizen. and I want to see the birth certificate. And I'm like, ugh. I'm like, dude, it's online. And he's like, no, I want to see the real one. I'm already thinking about punching this guy in the face. And I'm just like, yeah, all right, cool. And then she says, Tommy, who are you voting for in the election? And he's like, the Republicans, duh. After he walks away, I turn to Kathy and I'm like, hey, cool, thanks for introducing me to the retard. That was great. And she's like, yeah, I know, he's a retard. But he's our retard. And then she picks up her glass of margarita and she waves it at the crowd and says, they're all our retards. And they are going to sweep the Republicans into controlling the House and the Senate in this election.
And you're going to hook up with this woman?
Well, like, not at this point. I mean, I don't know if this point if she sexted me or was just wanted me to come there so she could gloat. So fortunately, this awesome thing happens. This really beautiful woman comes by. I mean, she's really put together. She looks gorgeous. She's got like this really nice tight fitting, a really nice cocktail dress on. She looks really classy, but I look kind of closely at her. She's got like this necklace. It's like diamonds with a tea bag in the middle. And she's got a concealed firearm on. I reach over to her and I say, hi, hey, what's your name? And she says, Mary. I'm like, hey, Mary, I'm Chris, and I'm a Democrat. And she's kind of like, And I said, and this is Kathy, and she's your Republican hall monitor. And she's kind of like, doesn't really know what that means either. And, you know, she's kind of like looking at both of us. And I'm like, Mary, what's the issue that's most important to you? And she says, gun control. I believe in the Second Amendment, and I'm afraid that Obama is going to take our guns. And I said, well, you obviously know who the Brady Foundation is, right? And she's like, yeah, of course I do. They're basically our arch enemies. And I'm like, right. Well, your arch enemy gave President Obama a gun control report card recently, a straight across the board Fs in all of their categories, background checks, gun show loopholes, gun trafficking, guns in public, federal assault weapons ban, standing up to the gun lobby and leadership. They gave him Fs in everything, Mary. So Mary just looks back at me and she's just like, you know, kind of looking at me like, what are you talking about? What planet are you from, buddy? And right then Kathy leans in to her ear and says, oh God, Mary, he's totally lying. Of course Obama wants to take away your guns. He's a Muslim.
Oh no.
Yeah. And I just look at Kathy at that point and I'm like, all right, it's on. It is f-ing on. So I say, Mary, are you concerned about the bailouts? And she's like, oh my God, definitely. I mean, Wall Street doesn't care about Main Street, and we just totally have to fix that. We have to reel these people in because they're just destroying the country. And I say, okay, well, if you really believe that, then I don't know what you're doing supporting Republicans, because they are the party of Wall Street. We need to build a wage base in this country, and you're not going to do that by protecting Wall Street. And at this point, Kathy says, like, blah, blah, blah. This is typical Democrats demonizing capitalism with all their complicated arguments. And that's why the Republicans and the Tea Party are to stick together, because we understand that keeping it simple and basic values are the way to go. Right, Mary? So I step in close to Mary and I look her in the eye and I say, well, I don't think you have to dumb things down for Mary. I think Mary's a lot smarter than you think she is. And I think she can understand what I'm talking about. And then I offered to buy Mary a drink.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. And she said, that would be great. So I turned my back on Kathy, I held out my elbow, and we walked away.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Tea Party Remix. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen. It featured Zephyr Teachout, Andrea Salenzi, Jill Lepore, Will Bunch, and our TMI special correspondent, Chris. The segments all come from a TMI series called Beyond the Fruited Plain. And you can listen to those in their entirety by going to the TMI playlist page. And that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. All that at WFMU.org.
Join us at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information.
Now, I have no doubt.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for the following areas: Orange, New York; Putnam, New York; Westchester, New York. And these will be in effect until 7:52 p.m. Up now, For the Record, with Dave Emery.
This is a rebroadcast of For the Record 412, recorded in June of 2003. With the recent debt limit crisis, ask yourself, is this relevant?
Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 412, titled, The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train. This is being recorded on June 2nd of the year 2003, and before we get into the substance of the broadcast, all of the For the Record programs and the other shows I've done over the years are available from Spitfire, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com, and you can visit the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Within a week or so, certainly within 2 weeks at the most, there will be a detailed article-length annotated description of For the Record 412 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, DAVEEMORY. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked both to the SpitfireList.com website and to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website. Now, to For the Record 412, the title is a phrase that I have used several times in the past, alluding to the Bush administration, which I believe very firmly to be the point element of a Third Reich gone underground. And I believe that at one level, the war on terror and the engagement of the U.S. in a very economically costly war against various peoples of what then the Third Reich referred to as the Earth Island, and the slashing of federal revenues at the same time as there was an enormous increase in expenditures in order to fight this very same war, I believe that this is aimed at the destruction and or subjugation of the United States. And I would note in that context that Grover Norquist, a key element of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, is not only the point man for the Al-Qaeda / Al-Taqwa Muslim Brotherhood link to the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. That was exposed in the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids that were instigated by the heroic John Loftus and his lawsuit against Sami Al-Arian. But those very same Operation Green Quest raids are inextricably linked with a system in which money, vast sums of money, is permitted to flow between countries in an unregulated fashion. And the aforementioned Grover Norquist, in addition to being the point man for the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood link to the Republican Party, is also the point man for the tax slashing for the Republican administration. He is one of the individuals, along with the Machiavellian and very much to be feared Karl Rove, whom I believe to be point men for the Bormann Organization and the Underground Reich in this administration. I have alluded to the combination of engaging the U.S. in a very costly war against the population of the Earth Island, a war which has again necessitated an enormous military buildup, at the same time as revenues are being slashed. And I have stated that I believe the engineer intends to wreck the train. I think that if, in fact, the United States is not destroyed physically and to a certain extent physically and economically by some monster terrorist incident, say a dirty bomb or the sabotaging of a nuclear power plant or some such thing, that would certainly cause an economic collapse in this country. I believe that a combination of building up the military to fight this perhaps perpetual or certainly long-term war in the Earth Island, and the combination of slashing the budget will destroy the United States, and that at some point in the future the United States, if indeed it even remains a single nation, if perhaps we are destroyed, I would not be surprised to see the South secede again successfully at some point in the future, perhaps the Pacific Northwest as well. But at the very least, we will be a subjugated nation. We will be completely bankrupted, and we will become, in effect, a source of cheap labor for Germany and a tree farm for Japan at some point in the future. That is why I have used the phrase in the past, the engineer intends to wreck the train. In this broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at economic considerations. We're going to be taking a look at the Bush administration's catastrophic and, in my opinion, deliberately suicidal tax cuts. We're going to be taking a look at some aspects of not only the war on terror, but in particular the situation in Iraq. And as I've stated in the past, I believe we were lured into a trap in Iraq. Who knows how it's ultimately going to work out? We won't know for another 8 to 10 years, both in terms of the Middle East and domestically. But there are indications that the invasion of Iraq is spurring Islamic fundamentalism, and it remains to be seen exactly what happens in the future. But I think in some ways the decision to go ahead with military action in Iraq may turn out to be a military decision along the lines of what Hitler made when he decided to invade the Soviet Union and open up a two-front war against the advice of his best generals. We have opened up a second front in the war on terror.